Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of BBC World News America, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The case of a UVA lacrosse player who was allegedly beaten to death by her boyfriend has brought attention to a persistent problem on college and high school campuses. Joining us in the studio to talk about how intimate partner violence impacts young people, are Judge Susan Carbon, Director of the US Justice Department's Office on Violence Against Women, and Cindy Southworth of the National Network to End Domestic Violence. Joining us by phone from Davis, California, is Dr. Elizabeth Miller. And joining us from a studio in Laguna Niguel, California, is Dr. Jill Murray, author of But I Love Him. Thank you all very much for joining me, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. We would like to hear your questions and comments, and we'll be opening those phones just a little bit later on in the program. Judge Susan Carbon, I wanted to start with you. Do we know how common abusive relationships are amongst young people?
We have a lot of good information about the extent to which teen dating violence or abuse exists among young people in this country. We know, for example, that the Centers for Disease Control report that nearly 10% of all teenagers have been subjected to physical violence in the past year. That's a statistic that they've reported. It's just under 10%. And this is both boys and girls. This is for physical violence. We also suspect, because it would be true with adults, that if there is that much physical violence, then there's also likely to be a much greater violence of emotional abuse as well. We know, in addition to this, that on college campuses, partner abuse, intimate partner abuse, is the most common cause of assaults on campuses, and that we have nearly 34% of the incidents on college campuses are related to intimate partner abuse. So it's a pretty significant factor.
And Cindy Southworth, as far as I understand it, women between the ages of 17 to 24 are at the greatest risk of being victims of domestic violence or intimate partner abuse.
It is. And when you think about that's a high time for dating. You tend to have more than one dating partner in those years. And if you date more, you have a higher risk of dating abuse. And so we are very concerned about young women between the ages of 16 and 24. And of course, men are abused too, but at a much smaller rate.
And is this on the rise? Do we know? Can we measure whether abusive relationships between dating partners of that age are rising?
I think it's tempting to say that because we're seeing increased reporting that we're seeing increased incidents. But in reality, we now have hotlines and helplines, and we're doing dating violence prevention and intervention programming on college campuses and in high schools. And what we're finding is that more people are coming forward, but it doesn't necessarily indicate that dating abuse itself is rising. We've had dating abuse since we started dating millennium ago, and now people are finally coming forward and talking about it.
And what does the case at UVA tell us about abusive relationships?
I think it tells us what we have known for decades, is that dating abuse and domestic violence cross all boundaries: race, ethnicity, class, income, education, profession, you name it, anybody can be a victim. I have a master's degree specializing in violence against women, and I could be abused in my next relationship. It's not about the victim.
One thing that we hear about the UVA case, Dr. Jill Murray, is that nobody knew beforehand. And a lot of people have said, if only we knew something, if only somebody had said something, if only there had been some sort of indications, then we could have, the outcome would have been different. Then we could have done something to protect this young woman. But aren't the signs of an abusive relationship precisely that we don't know, that these people, that women or men, retreat into themselves and don't tell other people?
Well, you're right in a certain extent there, Katie, is that with dating violence, as with adult domestic violence, there's a lot of shame and secrecy and hidden value to it. However, if we look at really signs that occur in most dating abuse relationships, I think we could have seen a lot more. And I don't know if we could have prevented it necessarily, because girls, when they're in abusive relationships, oftentimes don't want to look at this square in the face. But, you know, it would seem from the reports that we've heard that allegedly he had a problem every now and again with drinking and, you know, public intoxication and some entitlement issues and anger issues. And so, you know, when we look at things like that, usually that's across the board. signs that we can look at of a potentially abusive dating relationship.
And Jill, if you're a mother of somebody, of a young teenage girl, what are you looking for? What are the signs that you would advise mothers to look out for?
Oh, gosh, there's so many signs, Katie. I think that not necessarily in this case, but across the board, I think that we can look at isolation. Is your daughter being isolated from her friends, from you, her family, from her outside activities, from her house of worship, by her abusive partner? Because the design of this is that if he isolates her from everything else, then he becomes her only influence and very powerful in her life, and she doesn't feel like she can leave him even if she would want to. A lot of times these girls spend a lot of time crying, apologizing for things they've never done. They're texted constantly. The cell phone is attached to their ear constantly or attached to their thumbs. And a lot of this texting happens between midnight and 5 a.m. So I would certainly advise parents to look at their children's cell phone bills. There's a lot of fear, obligation, guilt. So certainly if you are a parent and you notice that your daughter is isolated from her friends, that she's very fearful, that she's dressing in baggier clothes, for example, that she's wearing less makeup, that she is more removed from you. If you try to talk to her about this, about her boyfriend, and she blames herself for the bad behavior, makes a lot of excuses for him, all these sort of signs, Katie, are really easy for parents to look at.
Dr. Elizabeth Miller, you're an assistant professor of pediatrics at the School of Medicine at the University of California, Davis. You've done research on abuse in teenage dating relationships. Is there something specifically about teenagers and young women that makes them more vulnerable to this than old women? I'm just wondering whether the abusive patterns are different, because we've talked on this program before, and of course we've all heard a lot about domestic violence between couples who are older and between married couples. I was just wondering if you see different patterns with younger women and teenagers.
Certainly. So, you know, in terms of the unique characteristics of adolescent relationship abuse, I think there's several things that need to be underscored. You know, I think one of them is that, as Dr. Murray was referring to, in terms of social networking, cell phone, texting, so, you know, in terms of the younger generation's connectedness to social media, also does increase the potential for their partner to control and monitor their behaviors using those social media, that we as adults and specifically as parents have a much harder time monitoring. So I think certainly social media has created a very different and unique landscape for adolescent relationship abuse. I think the other piece is, unlike domestic violence, which or traditionally we thought sort of occurs within the four walls of a home, adolescent relationship abuse occurs in our community, within schools and, you know, after school programs and wherever it is that young people are hanging out. That means that the ways in which boundaries are crossed and where the abusive behaviors can occur doesn't happen sort of discreetly in a specific place. And that also makes it more complicated. Among, you know, some of the cases that I have been involved in have involved how do you actually enforce a protective order for a young woman who's in an abusive relationship when that abusive partner attends the same school. So there are some complicated and unique characteristics, I think, of minors.
Do you also find that there is more pressure than there was, say, 10 years ago on teenage girls to be having sexual relations earlier, and that opens them up to abusive relationships?
So in terms of the pressure around sexual activity, I think if we look at the kind of media that our young people are exposed to, the extent to which early sort of sexualization in particular of girls, I think certainly has an impact. I think what you're asking about, of course, are the social norms, the extent to which sexual violence is normalized in young people's lives.
Judge Carbon?
Yeah, I'd love to add to that. I think another unique difficulty with teens that's distinguishable from adults is that at such a young age, and I would agree that the sexualization of youth is getting at lower and lower ages, but another unique concern is that teens themselves have a more difficult time navigating relationships because they're in the developmental stages, and it's hard for them to know what is appropriate behavior and what are appropriate expectations. Teenagers are always faced with peer pressure. And that's one of the most difficult challenges that adults have in working with teens, to help them learn how to cope with their own relationships. This can't be a top-down, we will tell you what to do, we will direct your social life. It just does not work that way with youth. So we need to assist them in learning and identifying what are abusive tactics that they may not see themselves. We know that lots of kids don't see necessarily that the extent to which somebody is texting them or calling them or trying to isolate them is a form of control. They may perceive this to the contrary as, this is somebody who really thinks I'm special, they want to be with me, they love me, and they identify in a very ironic way that controlling behavior as love and affection, when it's quite the opposite.
Cindy Southworth, we talked about some of the characteristics of a teenager who's being abused. What should we look for in an abuser?
One of the things that I think we need to encourage young folks and all of us to look at is, if we see a young person or anyone of any age constantly texting, constantly threatening, putting down their partner, talking about their partner in disparaging ways, there's a problem there. And we need to, as a community, confront it
head
on. But
the reality is that most parents, I have two teenagers, I probably don't know what their relationships are with their partners if they have one at school.
That's where I think, with Judge Carbon's point about we need to do more work with young folks, because the most successful teen and young person prevention efforts are really done by young people. And so you have to have young people in the classroom, young people on campus talking about safety. If we do it, we come across as stodgy old folks.
Okay. Cindy Southworth is vice president and founder of the Safety Net Project at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. I'm also joined by Judge Susan Carbon from the Department of Justice. Dr. Jill Murray, a psychotherapist, is with us on the line. Dr. Elizabeth Miller is also with us from Davis, California. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. We'd love to hear your questions and comments on this very important subject of dating violence. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our program discussing dating violence. And I wanted to ask Dr. Elizabeth Miller, who is joining us on phone, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the School of Medicine at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Miller, how can you explain to a young person, a teenager or somebody in their early 20s, when a relationship is crossing an abusive line? I've heard a lot during the program already about texting and control, but teenagers do that all the time anyway. I see it with my own kids. How do you explain when it's crossing a line that shouldn't be crossed, and when to start saying no and seeking help?
Absolutely, Katie. So I think the question is around, how do you help young people define what is a healthy relationship and what's an unhealthy relationship? And how do you help young people develop that gut sense of when a boundary has been crossed? And I think echoing what many of the panelists are talking about this morning is the importance of education. Many of our young people do not have an opportunity in school, at home, to have a conversation about what constitutes a healthy relationship. And by healthy relationships, we mean respectful, one in which you listen to each other, you have fun together, that's free of coercion, free of control, and certainly free of violence. But when we actually look at the kind of sexuality education that youth are getting, there really is very little discussion around healthy relationships and unhealthy relationships. So in fact, how are youth supposed to figure out where those boundaries are? They look to the media, they listen to songs, they see TV shows, and what they see overwhelmingly is violence and control in relationships. And so to the point that unhealthy relationships, unfortunately, become sort of an expectation. So, you know, how do we help young people sort of develop that sense of boundaries? I think it's absolutely critical that in our schools, in our communities, and in our homes, that we are actually talking to young people about what to expect in a good and respectful relationship.
George Carbon, we were talking in the break, and Elizabeth was just picking up on it there, about the general attitude of society to violence and to women in society, and how you thought that played into this particular problem.
I think that we have in this country what I would call somewhat of a cultural schizophrenia. We embrace violence in so many different ways, in our sports, in our music. And if we have this culture of violence in which it is normal and acceptable in one form, how do we teach people that in a personal relationship, it's not okay? And that's part of the challenge that we have in educating and making the public aware about what good relationships are. That's something in particular that when we work with youth, we need to design awareness campaigns and peer-to-peer mentoring relationships so they will know how to define an appropriate relationship, how to see the signs that sometimes adults don't see in their relationships, and how they can actually assist one another, and the variety of services that we have available for youth now that we didn't not too long ago.
Dr. Jill Murray, you've written a book titled But I Love Him, Protecting Your Teen Daughter from Controlling Abusive Dating Relationships. Do you think that schools, coaches, parents are doing enough to point out the kinds of issues that we've been talking about to teenage girls?
Oh, I don't think so. You know, I'm often asked, as I'm sure your other panelists are, is this problem worse than before, or are we just talking about it more? And I think it speaks to your question. I think both. And I think that we're not talking about it enough. And we've talked a lot about education in the schools, and I think that's absolutely critical. I think that a curriculum, a mandated curriculum in high schools is critical. And I think parents need to buck up and start being parents again and start talking to their kids about abusive relationships, about healthy relationships. I think they need to take control of their households and take control of what goes on with their kids and stop being pals and have expectations and make demands of appropriate behavior, including what they listen to, what they watch, what they read, the video games and computer games they play, about how long they spend on the computer on social networking sites, about not having your telephone with you on your cell phone when you go to sleep when it's absolutely unnecessary. I don't mean to sound like a Gestapo parent, but I see a lot of times where parents really don't enforce any of that, where they're afraid of their kids and they're afraid of not being cool and being their kids' friends instead of their parents.
Cindy Southworth.
And to add to that, I also think it's really important that parents role model a healthy, respectful relationship, that if we want to truly make sure that our children have healthy, safe relationships, we need to eradicate the concept of henpecked and who wears the pants in the relationship. As long as those are even in verbalized voice, relationships are about power, they're not about partnership. And parents need to role model. If we want our young folks to turn off their phones and not text during dinner, parents need to turn off their BlackBerries.
Judge Carbon.
One other piece of this as well is that with teen dating violence, and kids don't call that teen dating violence, so we'll address that in a moment, but parents often don't understand how it is that their kids are being abused or manipulated through the use of technology. That's one of the major challenges that we have, because if they don't see it happening, they may see a boyfriend coming over to the house and how he treats their daughter, but they're not going to see the extent to which the technology, the cell phone or the internet, is being used to manipulate their daughters. So unless they have a better understanding, they're not going to be able to intervene because they may not see anything happening. So we need to educate parents about how to look for those signs and where they may be and how they happen.
You were going to mention how it's called, the terminology.
Kids don't use the term dating any longer. That was something that back in the 50s or 60s or when we grew up, we would call that. But kids don't use that concept any longer. They talk about hooking up, they talk about relationships, they do things in groups, but they don't identify it as such. And so we need to talk within their context and use language and messaging that they can communicate with. And that's why we've designed programs for kids that they themselves will be able to understand and use and relate to. And if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to bring them in and engage them in solving some of these problems that we have.
Dr. Miller, I wanted to bring you in on this conversation. Looking at the technological side of it, we've talked a lot about texting and social networking, and to what extent internet service providers are aware of this problem, to what extent they have a role in this problem or some sort of ability to prevent it. And also, more broadly, who is it that can do a better job of telling young girls and young women how to stop themselves from getting into an abusive relationship and how to get out of one if they are in it?
So I think that, you know, it really does end up being the entire village. So it really requires a community response. I think, you know, all of our panelists are underscoring the critical importance of parents, in that parents may be, you know, aware of teen dating abuse in some vague sense, but, you know, as with many other adolescent risk behaviors, they say, well, that's not going on with my child. So I think all of us are saying, parents, please, please, please wake up, pay attention to what's going on with your kids' relationships, their friendships, and communicate. But that doesn't stop there. Obviously, we need to get our schools, our faith-based organizations, our after-school programs all on the same page in terms of helping young people define healthy relationships. And I can't underscore enough how much we need to support youth to mentor each other, to support each other in standing up and saying, you know, it's really not okay. That includes programs that engage men and boys in promoting healthy relationships. Where is a young man supposed to get information about how to treat a young woman if he doesn't get it in schools, at home, and in his community? So we really need many, many more programs that challenge the current sort of notion that masculinity is somehow connected to violence. You know, a strong man is not a man who hurts women and girls. Yet where are young men and women getting their messages?
Cindy.
I think it's really important to be careful to not talk about relationship violence as something that a victim might have any control over and might choose to go into. I think the best way to frame it is for potential abusers is you have no right to have any power over your partner. If you want to have a partnership, that's what dating, hooking up, whatever you want to call it is about. It is not having power over another individual. And MTV is actually doing a thin line campaign, and it's focusing on that thin line between healthy relationships and digital drama, as they're calling it, where you cross that line. And I think they're the right people to be doing it because they're MTV and they're not us, you know, older folks that kids aren't going to listen to.
Okay, we have a lot of callers who are calling, and I want to go to Sheila in New York. Sheila, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Hi, yes. You have a question and a comment for our panel?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the part about parents, because as a stodgy old person with two teenagers, I see major adult irresponsibility everywhere. When my daughter was in third grade, there were mothers pushing their daughters to date them. And as these girls have gotten older, well, they've gotten into some relationships that aren't so good, but the mothers seem totally blind to this because it's so cute. Look at my daughter, she's so popular. And I was wondering what happened to the idea that you were a person that could learn and go to school and learn things without having to have that guy with you. And it just seems like the whole thing has been sliding backwards as far as sexuality to the over-sexuality, but also on the other side, where it's abstinence only, you're still only a sexual figure, you just don't do it. But you still have to have the boyfriend.
Yeah, I think, Sheila, this is very interesting because we were talking about this during the break about whether there is pressure on girls to have sexual relationships earlier. And what you're suggesting there is that there is pressure to date earlier as well. And that, you know, even in third grade, but I think this is particularly, you know, in middle school and the early years of high school, you're meant to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Judge Carbon, are you seeing that happening, that phenomenon happening, that it's really, you sort of have to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend to be cool at school? And does that contribute to this problem?
I think it absolutely contributes to the problem. I think kids are expected, part of their peer relationships is expected to be popular. That's the culture of youth. And the one way in their mind to do that is to have a girlfriend or boyfriend. And if you're working in, I mean, they don't necessarily have serial or monogamous relationships as youth, but being popular is part of being in that culture. We've seen over time a much lower age at which sexualization begins. And with kids in particular, we know that 1 in 3 girls, at least some of the private research would show that 1 in 3 girls between the ages of 16 and 18 would expect that if they're going to continue in a relationship, then sex needs to be involved. So that trickles down with younger and younger children who think that they need to start developing relationships and gearing toward a sexualized approach.
Is it just that the sexual relationships are starting younger, or is it that the nature of the sexual relationships has changed as well? Because I don't know if this is just as a vigilant mother of teenagers, but I hear stories about sexual relations between teenagers in high school that sound to me already abusive, that there is something about them that is very degrading towards young girls. And I'm wondering whether that the nature of the very first sexual experiences that girls are having has changed as well. Judge Carbon?
I would.
Cindy?
It's one of those tricky lines, because I do think there is a tendency for all of us as we get older to think back, when I was younger, that never happened. And, you know, yes, high school was 25 years ago for me, but we had controlling, abusive, inappropriate things happening then. So I just caution us to not distance ourselves from the good old days, because the good old days had dating violence too, and pressure to have sex and pressure to be dating.
Dr. Miller, can I bring you in on this?
Certainly. And I do think, you know, it's very we certainly know that sexual assault has been, unfortunately, part of young women's lives, as Cindy is pointing out, for decades. I mean, those of us who've been doing violence-related work know that this is not new news. I think the what we need to understand is the extent to which many of young women's first sexual relationships may be one where there's coercion, where there was actual assault and rape. And those women who have survived sexual assault talk about how their first of such experiences occurred before the age of 25. So what is that about in terms of the extent to which young women's early sexual experiences are associated with coercion and rape? And that is, I think, part of the this landscape that we really need to work on shifting. And I have to say, in the last 5 years, there has been so much more focus on relationship abuse, which I think, you know, I'm feeling so hopeful and so optimistic that as, you know, men and women, girls and boys, that we can really start to have many more open conversations about how there can be positive sexuality that is not violent, that's not coercive, and be very clear about defining that for our young people.
Judge Carbon, you wanted to jump in there.
Sure. One of the most important factors for us to consider is that with youth, as they enter into relationships that are abusive when they're young, they're more than 3 times more likely to continue in abusive relationships as they get older. So I think the focus of our conversation really needs to be on moving things back to work on prevention so that we can break that cycle of violence that is continuing. And whether they are becoming more sexualized as younger kids or not, it's that we need to intervene earlier, get more preventive services for kids so that they don't become abused adults.
Okay, I want to bring in a few emails that we've received. I have a lot of phone calls waiting. They are all from women. We've received emails as well, and several from, like this one, which comes to us from Charlie, asking, are there any numbers concerning the abuse that young men endure in teenage relationships, or are they underreported? Abuse comes in many forms, physical abuse being the most obvious and quantifiable. Psychological and emotional abuse is often overlooked, but can be perpetrated by both sexes. And I have a couple of emails also along these lines. And we should point out that, of course, young men do get abused as well, right, Cindy?
Absolutely. And there are some men are abused by heterosexual female partners, and other men are abused by male partners. And there are some phenomenal services out there for gay men, specifically the Gay Men's Domestic Violence Project in Boston. And more we're trying to reach out to any victim. It's not about gender. Gender plays in because of power in our culture, but we serve all victims, and domestic violence and dating violence services across the country will help any victim, regardless of gender.
Dr. Murray, I want to pick up on something that Elizabeth Miller was just saying on the issue that she said she felt optimistic that people are talking about this more and that progress has been made. Do you share that optimism?
I would like to say I share it.
I'm not going to twist your arm to say anything you don't believe.
Thank you so much. I work in private practice. I have a private psychotherapy practice. And, of course, like many of our other guests, do presentations and seminars across the country as well. And I have to say that what I see is kids coming into my practice and kids coming up to me after speaking at schools and such that are 12 years old and 13 years old and having the sort of dating or hooking up problems, as Judge Garvin said, that we used to see just maybe even 3 or 4 years ago in 16 and 17-year-olds. So this is happening earlier and earlier, and what I feel very upset about is that this is a time, as far as I'm concerned, as a psychotherapist, the teenage years are really not supposed to be about what college are you going to and what career are you going to have. And so, you know, right before high school starts, you get put on a track so that you can accomplish those things, but more about what kind of person do I want to become and what do I believe in. And when you start dating this early, it's all lost.
Jill Murray is a psychotherapist. She joins us on the phone. We are having a conversation about dating violence. Please do join our conversation. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. I'm Cathy Kay. We're going to take a quick break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Daniel Okrant looks at an era when drinking didn't stop. For a while, it just went underground.
Pro-prohibition people were out there marching and organizing and voting, and the anti-prohibition people were too busy drinking to do any of those things.
Shaken or stirred, join us.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation on dating violence. I have in the studio Judge Susan Carbon. She's director of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women. Cindy Southworth is here. She's vice president of the Safety Net Project. And I'm joined as well by Dr. Jill Murray, a psychotherapist from California. Dr. Elizabeth Miller is also with us from the University of California, Davis. I want to go straight back to the phones to Amanda in Rochester, Michigan. Amanda, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I just wanted to know if you could tell us about your experience and whether you have any questions for our panel.
Sure. I just recently was out of an abusive relationship that ended in October, beginning November, and sort of a looming question I've had is what responsibility does a college institution have in responding to abusive relationship within their student body?
Okay, Amanda, a little bit more. You are how old?
I'm 23, and I'm just a recent college graduate.
And what steps did you take when you were in your abusive relationship? Did you turn to the college? Did you ask anybody for help? Did you feel that you did try to reach out to people?
Well, you know, the mind-boggling thing is I had no idea it was an abusive relationship for the longest time, not till the tail end of it. And then obviously once I gained awareness, the whole relationship fell apart because he realized he couldn't control me as much anymore. It was my first relationship I'd ever been in. They put on a very good show. They were very, very religious people, very, very well-known in the church and in the college.
When you say they, who do you mean they?
I'm sorry?
You say they were very religious people and they put on a good
show. His family was very involved. His mother is on staff at Rochester College. It was sort of like a whole family manipulation. I mean, he was a full-blown drug addict and alcoholic. And whenever he would be angry or upset or rage, his mother would tell me, well, he's just irritable today because he didn't eat anything. So it was just a continual path of everyone covering up the lies so that I wouldn't know what was going on. So it just took me I didn't realize that I was in an abusive relationship. So I think after the relationship actually ended and I was in therapy.
Amanda, did he abuse you physically?
Physical abuse was not that bad. It was just maybe, he was really squeezing me really hard and I had bruises the next day. And I'm an athlete, so I didn't think anything of it because I figured, he didn't realize how hard he was holding me. Or, you know, bending my wrist back when he was angry. So nothing too drastic because I'm an athlete, I would have responded. But it was just very subliminal and manipulation to where I didn't really realize that I was being abused.
Okay. I want you to stay on the line, Amanda, because I want to... There's several things that you raised there that I know that Cindy Southworth and I'm sure that our other guests would like to weigh in on. Cindy.
Amanda, I'm so sorry that you went through that. And there is no right amount or drastic amount of violence. And the emotional control, the coercion, and bruising you in any way is never okay. And I think in terms of campus response, we are seeing an improvement, but it takes time. And when I was a resident assistant at Penn State 20 years ago, we had dating abuse programs and healthy relationship programs on the campuses. And since the Violence Against Women Act has passed and now has programs and funding for campus services, things are getting better, but we still have a long way to go. And ideally, if you were to report it, the whole system should be supportive, from the resident assistants to the resident directors. If you were to get a protection order, the campus police should help enforce it. They should be willing to move the offender to a different dorm if need be. You know, the entire campus system should be responsive when a young person comes forward and says that I'm in danger.
Dr. Elizabeth Miller, what did you pick up on from what Amanda was describing?
I completely want to echo what Cindy is saying, and I think, you know, Amanda, I also want to say that nobody ever deserves to be abused, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us. In terms of campus response, I think, you know, this is also something that student bodies, that students can organize around as well, and really push for changes if it is not clear that there is, you know, a clear protocol in place within your university campus for bringing these issues forward. Is there a place for you to go to where you can talk about the abuse that you've experienced and get connected to appropriate services? The kinds of campus responses can also include your college health services, where healthcare providers can also be really good advocates. And I would really encourage students to reach out to college health to work together to raise awareness around relationship abuse.
Amanda, who did you reach out to at your college?
I spoke to the dean of students numerous times because his mother wouldn't leave me alone because I would break up with him and then she would guilt trip me back into going out with him. And his mother is on staff at Rochester College. And I would speak to the dean and I said, please don't have her contact me anymore or I'm going to get a restraining order. And they would just continue and it would just continue. And I don't even understand from a legal standpoint about how their staff is allowed to manipulate me into an abusive relationship and how she's still allowed to be on faculty there. It's to the point where I was not allowed to walk on stage and has not received my diploma because his mother was the person that hands out the diplomas and is at graduation. And so all these things were taken from me and they just choose to look the other way because she's been on staff for however many years.
Judge Carbon, you wanted to add something.
I just wanted to add, first of all, Amanda, I would concur with others. I'm very sorry you've had to experience this kind of behavior on your campus and to be subjected to what you've had to experience. The Office on Violence Against Women has a couple of relatively new programs to address violence on college campuses, and one we call the campus program, if you will, that focuses and works to collaborate campus security, with local law enforcement, and with advocacy services as well, so that we truly have a community collaboration around addressing both domestic and sexual violence on college campuses. This would be an issue that is of extreme importance to bring and expand throughout the college. We've recently undertaken, as part of our 15th year anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act, a set of tours on different college campuses around the country to speak out about the depth to which sexual and domestic violence is occurring, so that people will have a much greater understanding and be willing to stand up and take action against this kind of behavior.
And it sounds like Amanda's college could do with one of those tours. Amanda, I want to thank you for sharing your story. I know that it's very difficult to share these stories in public, and also to congratulate you for having the strength to get out of the abusive relationship when there was so much pressure on you to stay in it. Amanda, thank you very much for joining the Diane Rehm Show. I want to go now to Tanya in Baltimore, Maryland. Tanya, you've joined the program.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd like to, you know, there's been a lot of great conversation and meaningful conversation about the need to educate youth in school settings, but it seems as though the general public is thinking of education in high schools. And as the manager of a teen dating violence program at the House of Ruth in Maryland, I'd like to point out and make really clear that education with youth should start far earlier than in high school. We've been working with middle school and high school age youth and colleges, but last year we launched a program for elementary school youth that focuses on healthy friendships, because there's some really key concepts that run across this conversation, whether we're talking to very young children or, you know, children or young people who are in college settings. There are concepts that relate to respect in relationships, whether it's a friendship or an intimate relationship, and, you know, kind of sharing power and having a relationship that's based on equality are all kind of key pieces. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Dr. Murray, do you want to pick up on Tanya's comments?
Yes, I think that's very well spoken. I actually speak at elementary schools and middle schools quite a lot, both to children and to parents, and I talk about bullying and friendship. You know, a lot of times the abuser that we see in high school or the abuser that we see in college was the bully on the playground in second grade. And so to talk with parents about what is not acceptable, what is not cute, what you don't want your kids to get away with, and the reasons why, and to help them be healthier people in that way, and to talk about friendship in terms of equality, male-female friendships, same-gender friendships, I think is absolutely critical. As Tanya intimated, it's certainly far easier to prevent dating violence than it is to solve it when it's full-blown, as Amanda found out.
Because it's so difficult to get out of those relationships.
Yes, it certainly is. It's very difficult, and primarily because there's a lot of fear and a lot of shame and a lot of secrecy. Plus, the victim has been made to feel horrible, bad, that nobody will ever want her, that he's the best that she can possibly do. And as you know, possibly with your teenagers, and when all of us were teenagers, everything is drama, 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 you know, to the 10th power, and we can't really see beyond today, and everything is big and bad and horrible if we're feeling badly, or conversely, everything is great to the 10th power if we're feeling fabulous. And I think primarily as women, Caddy, we're very relationship-focused, and we sort of filter everything through relationships. A lot of times when we get together with other women, mostly what we talk about is relationships, partner relationships, relationships with our kids, with our friends, with our pets, with our employers or employees or coworkers. We talk about relationships. And so our lives can be going great, but if our relationships aren't going well, our lives really stink. And so particularly for younger women who are just getting involved in relationships and have dreamt about relationships since they've been 3 years old, this is very critical. And that's part of what makes it so difficult to get out of an abusive relationship as well.
I want to bring an email here that Stan writes to us from Laytonville, Maryland. I understand that the considerable warning signs about the conduct of the UVA male lacrosse player were observed by his teammates, but the code or organizational culture of the team prevented them from reporting multiple incidents of violence. How can we crack this tendency of peers to protect their group or organization, right or wrong, Cindy?
There are phenomenal organizations out there engaging young people in speaking up and saying something. And I've seen PSAs and poster campaigns designed by youth for youth. And the strongest message is speak up, say something, do something, because we do see it. And young people do see it. And it's not okay to watch a teammate or a classmate putting down their girlfriend, threatening, talking about how I'm going to get her back or whatever. And so I'm not speaking about this particular case. But in any case, if you observe a friend of yours, a classmate or a teammate saying anything dangerous, speak up and act, because you could be saving someone's life.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. There is another email that has come to us, and I think this is an interesting case. It is related to the UVA case, it says, but I think it's a broader issue as well. And the emailer writes, "You will find a high percentage of incidents of alcohol and or abuse, and alcoholism is a driving factor with young people and or rape. Must start correcting the root causes. Alcohol on the campuses of America needs to be addressed. This most recent case is classic." Cindy, do you find that that is an issue, that alcohol or drug abuse is associated particularly with rape?
I like your term associated, because it's more of a correlation than causation. And when it comes down to it, women are raped regardless of substances, and often substances are used as a way to facilitate the rape. It's considered sort of drug-facilitated or alcohol-facilitated rape. If you see a target, someone you want to rape, you ply her with alcohol earlier in the evening. So the alcohol didn't cause it. The alcohol was the tool. And with same with domestic violence, we see women that are abused, and sometimes they feel like it has a correlation with the alcohol because he came home drunk, but he stopped at the bar to start drinking because she left the house today when he told her not to leave the house. So then his excuse is, "I'm so sorry, honey, I was drinking," when it was a very deliberate attempt to get drunk to excuse the behavior when there is no excuse ever.
Okay, let's go to Sean in Boston, Massachusetts. Sean, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show. Sean, Hello. Are you there? Yep.
Yes, I am. One thing I want to bring up is, as a parent, and I'm in technology, I have a real difficult time in this new age, and I'd say it's over the last 5 or 6 years, of being able to control children's access to technology. When my kids are at home, I can monitor anything they're doing on the internet. But when they get to school or other places that they have access to social media sites, I have no control over that. And I'm just blown away by the types of things that children are saying to each other. And there's no way as parents that we can monitor that technology.
Okay, Cindy, you wanted to jump in there. And Sean, I should remind you, works in technology.
And as the geek on the panel here, I'm also feeling your pain here. And I understand your struggle as a parent. At the same time, we've never been able to control our young people. I passed notes in middle school that had things on it that I never should have put in writing. And there was no way for parents to control that then, just as there's no ways for parents to completely control what young people do now. And question whether that's the right goal, because it's really hard for you as a parent to tell your teenage daughter that no boyfriend, no partner is ever allowed to fully control everything you do, but I can because I'm the parent. That's a really interesting dichotomy. So we actually really caution parents from using spyware programs to keep an eye on their teenagers and young person's computer activities, unless it's visible. If you have a dialogue with your young person and say, "We're going to put this monitoring software on the computer, it's visible, you know it's there, you know I'm monitoring," that's a dialogue and a discussion. But surreptitious surveillance of your teenagers is – that's actually a crime if it happens between a boyfriend and girlfriend. People are prosecuted for that. It's called eavesdropping and electronic crime. So we don't want to do to our young people what we want their boyfriends and partners not to do also.
Judge Cobbin.
And I would encourage any parent to have their kids look at some of the websites that really help the kids themselves identify what are abusive behaviors and have the kids try to access services, because that's a better way to try to change the paradigm, if you will, so that we can start to prevent some of this from happening. There's a great new website that's been produced that our office actually funded with the Family Violence Prevention Fund and the Ag Council, called thatsnotcool.com. It's a great resource for youth to look at and start to see and understand, by participating in this interactive website, what they can do. Another great one is loveisrespect.org. That's an interactive chat room where kids can talk to somebody, they can get immediate services, and that's a great way for kids to connect with others who can really help them through these
I like this. We have a couple of minutes left on the program. Dr. Miller, do you have any specific advice along the lines that Judge Carbon was giving us there?
Absolutely. I just want to jump in and thank Sean for his call, because I think the key piece that we're asking parents to do is to maintain open and honest communication with your children. And as an adolescent physician, that's what I encourage the parents of my patients to do at all times, is to stay connected and to communicate. It's not about, you know, getting in there putting spyware on your kid's computer, but much more about saying, you know, when you start to feel uncomfortable, when something is going on, I want you to know that you can come to me and I will not judge you. And I think it's that kind of connectedness with one's children that we really want to encourage parents do.
Okay, Dr. Elizabeth Miller, on that note, you get the last word of the program. Thank you very much for joining me, Dr. Elizabeth Miller, Dr. Jill Murray, Cindy Southworth, Judge Susan Carbon. Thank you all very much, ladies, for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much.
I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back tomorrow. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.